Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears back with you here on this historic day in Marion, Ohio history. Wednesday, August the 2nd, 2023, 100 years to the day of the death of President Warren G. Harding, August 2nd, 1923. Joining us in studio, President Warren G. Harding. President Harding, so glad you could be with us today. It is August 2nd, 1923. And the last speech you gave, tell the circumstances of how it came about, when it was, and you're going to give it to us.
Well, tell you what, if we have time to do it, let me take you through the Voyage of Understanding itinerary. I just mention, you know, bit by bit some of the things that happened along the way, and then leading to the appearance in Seattle. Dr. Sawyer was hoping this would be, he was counting on it being a relaxing experience for the president so that, that I could recover. But as anybody who knows me knows, I love to talk. I love to give addresses. I love to meet people. If I'm before a crowd of 25,000 people, I'm energized by that. I draw energy from the crowd. I enjoy learning from the crowd and the people I meet. That type of thing helps guide my policy making, my decision making. So I didn't have any intentions of spending 8 weeks or more lounging about in a luxury Pullman car. That was in opposition to the advice that I was getting from my physicians. Just relax, Warren, just relax. Well, I knew I could relax some, but I had opportunities to reach people, to meet people, and to talk, and I took every advantage of that. Sometimes we got out of the car and we attracted a large crowd or something was planned for me to appear. Other times, you understand, this was a steam locomotive, so we had to stop for water frequently. And even at these water stops, we just stopped to refill, and there'd be a couple dozen people gather around the train, and I'd go to the back of the Pullman car. There's a little, basically a porch there. I called it my back porch campaign, where I could just stand at the rear of the car and address whoever was there at the time. So some speeches were a big deal, and other speeches were just little impromptu things with a group of people that clustered around the rear of the car. But all in all, in 22 days that I was on the road prior to being in San Francisco, I made 85 speeches. Some of them big, some of them small, but from my sick bed here, looking back on that, that's far more than I really should have done. I should have paced myself better. By train, we left Washington, D.C. on June 20th. By the next day, we were in St. Louis, Missouri. I gave a large speech there. The next day, we were in Kansas City, Missouri. Again, a large speech. June 23rd, we were in Hutchinson, Kansas. And when I was giving speeches in these places, what I was doing was excerpting elements from my 1922 State of the Union, and it just gave me an opportunity to say, here's where we are, here are the problems that we continue to face, here are some of the problems that were legacy from the previous president, here are some of the new things that have cropped up, Here are the policies that my administration has taken to try to remediate these things. 1922 was a year of horrible strikes. The whole industrial complex of the United States was basically put on hold, the biggest of which was a rail strike. And there was a steel strike. And there was a coal strike. These are national strikes that shut down industries. And in 1922, I was dealing with not only Florence's illness, but dealing with finding a way forward to resolve these strikes that paralyzed the nation, imperiled the economy, and would put an end to the prosperity that we're beginning to see in the 1920s. By 1923, the economy was seeing some robust activity, the extent that people were starting to call it the Roaring Twenties. Well, that was refreshing because we had been through war, serious recession. We'd just come through the 1913 flu pandemic. And in fact, I had a bad case of influenza. I don't think it was the 1913 flu. I think it was another strain, but it was a very virulent strain of flu that happened a couple months before we left on our voyage of understanding. Back to our itinerary here, we went on to Denver, Colorado. We were there on June 24th. I went by train then to Cheyenne, Wyoming on June 25th, on to Salt Lake City, Utah. 27th of June, we were in Cedar City, Utah, and it gave me the opportunity to visit Zion Park, which is where the Navajo sandstone cliffs are. And I had brought along the Secretary of the Interior and others because I was recommending that Zion Park be absorbed by the federal government as a national park, as a treasure for the nation. Well, it wasn't that at the time, but I was hoping that the Interior Secretary would see the potential in adding Zion Park to the federal collection of national parks. So that was an important objective. Next day we went on to Pocatello, Idaho, and on to Idaho Falls. June 29th we went on to Butte, Montana, Helena, Montana. June 30th we visited Yellowstone National Park, which was a national park, and I got a chance to see Old Faithful go off. In July, started toward Washington, went to Spokane, then to Meacham, Oregon, then to Portland, Oregon, and then on to Tacoma, Washington. I was there on July 5th. I was in Portland for the 4th and the fireworks. In Tacoma, Washington, I had a huge crowd, addressed 25,000 people there. Pretty much gave the entire 22 State of the Union address, just updated it a bit for the crowd, but it was a here's what's going on kind of address for a crowd of 25,000. On July 5th, we took a jog in our tour, because up to this point we've been we've been aboard the Pullman car, the Superb. We've been traversing the continental U.S. on rail, but on July 5th we moved to sea transportation, and we boarded the USS Henderson. That was a transport ship by the U.S. Navy. The following day, we departed for Alaska, and there were so many stories to tell of the Alaska tour. Our first port of call in Alaska was Metlakatla. I always have difficulty pronouncing this. Metlakatla, where Florence was startled by very accomplished Native Alaskan musicians that were performing in their bare feet as they played for us. While we were there, we visited the grave of world-famous Anglican missionary Father William Duncan. Now, in missionary circles, he's a famous man. But also, Herbert Hoover, the Secretary of Commerce, was personally interested in Metlakatla because his uncle, Hoover, when Herbert Hoover was young, both of his parents died. He was raised by his uncle. Later, his uncle went on to marry a native Metlakatla woman. So he was very interested in reconnecting with some of his roots there. There was a lot of interest in that. Then we moved on to Ketchikan. There we accepted tributes of gold and ivory jewelry. We received some jewelry made out of gold nuggets, including a collar for Laddie Boy that was made entirely of solid gold nuggets. I laid the cornerstone for the Masonic Temple on Main Street. The July 8th call at Ketchikan was described by the press corps who was on board as notable for, quote, hillsides of wooden homes decorated with Independence Day bunting and misspelled signs. We went on then to Wrangell, Alaska. There we had a coterie of native Alaskans that paddled out to our ship by canoe, carrying colorful blankets with them in the canoes. We spent 3 hours ashore there in Wrangell, enjoying all the sights. And then we went on to Juneau. There our sightseeing party was guided by Alaska Governor Scott C. Bone. A wonderful man. I appointed him to the Alaska governorship. Again, it was not a state, it was a territory, but it still had a governor. I appointed Governor Bone to that position 3 years before. Now, I doubt that many people recognize the name Governor Scott C. Bone. So you may not recognize the name, but you might recognize one of his legacies, because he's the man that made the decision that relay dog teams would be the fastest mode of travel to deliver diphtheria serum to Nome, Alaska. Nome was going through a crisis, and the sled dogs basically saved Nome. And that decision, that act of the sled dogs, has been memorialized as the annual Iditarod race. Scott Bone is basically the father of what would become the Iditarod race. We went on then to Governor Bone's mansion. We had roughly 500 guests there. There was an outdoor dance, and then followed by a parade through town. So it was Governor Bone showed our contingent a wonderful time. Even before that, before we arrived at Juneau, people had decorated their businesses and homes with colorful bunting streamers and flags, and the light poles in town were wrapped with fresh evergreen boughs to decorate it for our arrival. In fact, as you walked up and down the street, there were photos of me and Florence displayed in most of the shop windows downtown. So we received a more vigorous and welcoming greeting at Juneau than nearly any other place. We arrived in Seward then on July 13th, and this is interesting. The scenery around Seward is so spectacular that we didn't want to see the scenery through the windows of a Pullman car. So we had a specially ordered Dodge Roadster with steel railroad wheels on it. And so it was, this was modified to that this Dodge Roadster could run on railroad rails. You may as well, because there are no roads. You know, if you had a car with rubber wheels, there's no place you could drive it. There's nothing but forests and mountains. So from this open convertible Roadster, Florence and I and some of our guests could enjoy the magnificent Alaska scenery without peering through windows to view it. One of our guests was James Steese, who was chairman and president of the Alaska Railroad that we were riding on. The Alaska Railroad was federally financed and federally owned as an effort by the federal government to open up Alaska for exploration, for visitation, and for development. We moved on to Wasilla, and then to Willow, and this was maybe one of the most noteworthy experiences. I had the opportunity to drive the train. I sat in the engineer's seat at the controls. Florence sat next to me in the fireman's seat, and these particular miles from Wasilla to Willow basically were the reason why the railroad had been built in the first place. There had been some rich gold strikes in the mountain chain along that route. They needed a train to transport gold to a saltwater port. A little farther north, the train entered coal-rich territory. It was clear that coal was another rich product of Alaska's mining wealth, and train would be necessary to move that product for export. I had a high honor the next day. We went on to Nanana. That doesn't sound like an Alaska town you may be familiar with, but that's where the Alaska Railroad East met Alaska Railroad West. And that's where the two joined up, and I had the honor of driving the Golden Spike that ritually connected the two ends of that railroad. And that railroad went on north to Fairbanks, which Fairbanks itself was its own center as a economic powerhouse, as an emerging gold-producing region. We went on then to Fairbanks. Fairbanks was the end of the railway. This is 1923. Fairbanks was founded in 1915. So as I addressed the crowd, I said, Fairbanks is the best 9-year-old city that I've found anywhere. Well, by the time we got to Fairbanks, Mrs. Harding had suffered a bout of exhaustion. She was feeling tired. I was feeling exhausted. And at that point, we left the railway and went on to Seward by automobile along one of the few highways that had been developed in that part of Alaska. It was called the Richardson Highway. And I can tell you that was a miserably long trip of bad road, a primitive road that was just ruts and rocks. And Florence was feeling poorly too, and to her, that leg of the trip was just dreadful. By July 17th, we were in Seward, and we boarded the Henderson again, and then continued on to Sitka, where we stopped on July 23rd for a festive celebration there, not quite as much as Juneau's, but it was well done. It was there the combined Navy, the Alaska Native Brotherhood, and the Fireman's Band all joined together and had a rousing performance at Siska by the Sea. We visited the Sheldon Jackson Museum and School, St. Michael's Cathedral, we visited there, and there was also an agricultural experiment station. It was interesting to see how agriculture in Alaska, just because of the lengths of the days and nights, how it varies from what we would expect in, let's say, the Midwest. In the afternoon, we reboarded the ship. When we did that, that's when my troubles really began, because that's when I started having abdominal pains. My fever started to rise. As we mentioned earlier, my doctors assumed it was food poisoning because I had all of those symptoms, but nobody else in our party had a problem with that. July 27th, we were about to depart for Seattle, Washington, on the USS Henderson, and we had, that day was horrible. The ship had major problems. The boiler room flooded. All hands were called into action to stop the flooding on the ship. And while that was happening, we all ran onto the deck, just because we felt we needed to do that to be safe in case the ship either went aground or capsized. But it was terribly foggy that day. You just could see a few feet beyond the rail of the ship. And our ship ran into a smaller destroyer ship in the mouth of the Puget Sound harbor, and that ship sank in the fog. So there we are. We've crushed into another Navy vessel. That vessel is sinking. Our own vessel is filling with water because of a serious water leak in the boiler room, and we're thinking this could be the end. You know, as much as we were all looking forward to the voyage of understanding, there were some premonitions of disaster. Looking back on it, about 2 weeks before we were to depart, the entire train, the super, including the Pullman car, were out west, being refurbished and fitted for the excursion. Everything needed to be maintained, painted, fitted with supplies, all the special accoutrements that a president would need in a Pullman car, all that happening. And as the super is climbing through a steep mountain pass, there's a rock slide, a big one, that comes down, knocks the locomotive off the rails, crushes the locomotive, and kills the engineer. Fortunately, the rest of the train was largely undamaged, but that cast a pall on the trip, knowing that our train was being pulled by a replacement engine, driven by a replacement engineer, because the one who should have been driving the train was killed in a tragic rock slide accident while behind the wheel of the train. That cast a bit of a pall on the trip even before we started. And then when this happened on the Henderson, we were wondering if this wasn't a trip that was somehow doomed. Because, as you'll recall, I may have mentioned in other interviews that we've had, Florence had a clairvoyant that she believed in. Some would say, well, that's a fortune teller, that's just superstition. But this clairvoyant, her name is Madame Marcia, and she was well-respected by a Supreme Court justice, other members of the Supreme Court, senior members of the Senate and the Congress. She seemed to have an ability to see the future in a way that, that there was truth in it. Enough so that she was credible. That sounds superstitious, that's whatever, but Madame Marcia had predicted to Florence that I would not survive the presidency. And I had been brushing that aside. That's just superstition. That's, you know, I didn't pay it any heed. Florence put far more credence in what Madame Marcia had to say than I ever did. But as we're standing on the deck of the Henderson, a small Navy destroyer just ahead of us, sinking in the fog, and on our own boiler room filling up with water, I began wondering if Madame Marcia might be right, especially given the fact that my own health seemed to be declining rapidly. We made our way to Vancouver. We did that via the Henderson. The Henderson, the crew were able to patch it up enough to be able to, I don't know if I'd call it seaworthy, but it was navigable. It could move. And in Vancouver, I mustered up the strength to address a crowd of 40,000 well-wishers there. Again, this is the first time an American president had been to Canada. And Vancouver's a populous city. And I was surprised at how many people turned out in the local stadium that were interested to hear what I had to say. My speech there wasn't so much about State of the Union things, because why would pretty much anybody from Canada care about that? My presentation was more on U.S. and Canada relations. There were a lot of rumors going on at the early 20th century that the U.S. had plans to annex Canada, that each province in Canada would be a state, and the whole, basically all of North America, with the exception of Mexico, would become the United States of America. And I was there, among other things, to reassure the citizens of Vancouver that there is no such plan. Canada is a sovereign nation, and Canada and the United States share many ideals with respect to freedom, economic freedom, political freedom, manifest destiny. I view Canada as a neighbor nation following a parallel track to the United States, that those tracks would never join, that they would always be in parallel to each other. So, I was exhausted after that. We left for Portland. We stopped at Merced, California, where we visited Yosemite. What an inspiring place. Went on to El Portal, California, and then finally San Francisco, which was a scheduled destination for us. But by the time we reached San Francisco, my medical team advised that we cancel everything beyond San Francisco and stay at the Palace Hotel until I had recovered sufficiently to proceed somewhere. So all of that led up to the last presentation that I made, which is why you started this conversation in the first place. I wanted to lay the groundwork before we did that. I was in Seattle, Washington. It was the 27th of July. I was at the University of Washington Stadium, the Husky Stadium. It's 4 p.m. The stadium is packed to capacity and is standing room only, estimated 25,000 people there. And the intent of this speech was to give the nation. I say the nation because this speech would be extensively covered by the press, and knowing that much of the text of my speech in Seattle would be in the newspapers the next day. Much of the purpose of the trip was to gain understanding of Western United States, but especially to gain understanding of Western Canada, and most noteworthy, Alaska. Alaska was a forgotten land. You may recall from history class, it was a purchase. It was called Seward's Folly. The federal government threw its money away when it bought this vacant tract of land for no good purpose. It seemed that nobody really gave Alaska much attention until the Alaska Gold Rush of a few years ago. And Alaska started seeming like it might be an interesting place. So I'd like to share what I've learned about Alaska. I've learned a lot of detail about Alaska that I'm not going to share in this speech about the status of the fishing industry and the logging industry and what are the economic prospects of Alaska and what are some of the transportation problems of Alaska. You know, those are all important things we'll deal with when I get back to Washington. So in this speech, I'm going to convey my general impressions. And I'll do that in an edited version of the speech. This speech is somewhere around 11 minutes long. My actual speech there was pushing 2 hours, which, as anybody knows, because I like to bloviate, I can't say hello in less than 10 minutes. So I'm addressing everybody. Fortunately, I have a sound system there provided by the Bell telephone system, so I don't have to shout. I wouldn't have the energy to do that. So I begin. My address is to Governor Hart, Mr. Mayor of Seattle, my countrymen all gathered around us today. It would be false to the promptings of my heart if I did not thank you with all the sincerity of my being for the cordiality of your welcome and the very fine tribute of courtesy shown by this wonderful gathering on a very hot afternoon. People sometimes think that the President of the United States ought not to travel. They think many things about the President which are wrong. Some of them even believe that he ought not to have any fun. But who would want to be President if he could not enjoy a little amusement occasionally? So as far as travel is concerned, however, I wish to convey to you the profound conviction which has come to me that I am better equipped to serve and more faithfully resolved to serve the nation than when I left Washington last June. One finds a new pride in this republic of ours and gains a new confidence in the unalterable determination and the patriotic devotion of the American people from the intimate contact with them made possible by seeing them in their own homes. So we are returned from Alaska, fresh with the impressions received in that great Northwestern Empire. It is a great, measureless, marvelous part of our cherished republic. Nature has been rich in the bestowal of resources and incomparable in her artistry. I wish I had language to convey the lure and the fascination which grow during every hour of a constantly wondering visit. Nature must have been in a lavish mood, not alone to create incalculable resources, but to adorn them with mountain and lake, and the streams and the waterfalls which connect them, until one may fancy a festival of creation, celebrating the mysterious miracle, with God himself making merry and tossing ribbons of falling water, 500, some 2,000 feet long, tossing those ribbons of water like confetti at a carnival. Words seem inadequate to portray the grandeur, to measure the magnificence, or express the mightiness, or claim the glory of monumental mountains and their jeweled valleys. Then, as a revelation of God's bounty, Nature reared the outstanding sentinel of North America to stand guard on top of the world, and in its serenity, we call it Mount McKinley. About its towering head, there is never-ending sunshine in the summer, and in the long winter, its unchanging garb of white reflects a sheen of glory no darkness can wholly dim. We saw it at 11 o'clock at night, 160 miles away, a revelation of glory that cannot be dwarfed even by distance. Somehow, Mount McKinley is distinctly typical of Alaska. So mighty, so measureless, so magnificent, resourceful, remote, with some great purpose yet unrevealed, to challenge human genius. A traveler to Alaska will find his contact with the finest, most hospitable people in all the world. The people of Alaska of today give no suggestion of the population which formed miracle settlements in the old gold rush days. The ruggedness of the territory is reflected in their vigorous health, and the freedom of the great out-of-doors is seen in their wholesomeness, in their cordial hospitality. But otherwise, Alaskan people are precisely the same as those back in the 48 states from whence they came. There is no finer citizenship in all of the United States. Indeed, in this citizenship lies the solution of what some call the Alaska problem. In them is the assurance of Alaska's ultimate and adequate development. No magic wand made from federal treasury gold may be waved to bring into effect this grand transformation. The process of development and the establishment of permanent and ample civilization in Alaska lie in a citizenship with homes in Alaska, not in investors who are seeking Alaskan wealth to enrich their homes someplace else. On our voyage of understanding, we have learned something, but its first effect has been to impress us that nobody yet truly knows Alaska. We have been astounded at the immensity of resources and possibilities. We have wondered at the variety of its riches, at the luxuriance of its glorious vegetation, at times at the almost tropic heat of its night-long summer days. We've thrilled to its wonder and felt the charm which holds it to the affections of all who once have breathed its air and lived its life. More than all, we have enormously strengthened our faith in the future of Alaska as a home of a great state in the American Commonwealth. A brave, hardy, enterprising, uncomplaining people are building for Alaska's tomorrow precisely as our forefathers in our older states built for ours today. And I am sure that they will, in their time, bring another great state into the Union. The delay in embracing Alaska is purely an economic one. The time is not yet ripe for fruition in Alaska. With a transportation problem and with the present supply of materials throughout the United States much nearer their markets, conditions have not until now called for Alaskan development. And the reasons are precisely the same that caused Ohio to be settled long before Nebraska or Kansas ever were. Those states were too far away. There wasn't the transportation to be able to reach them. And those naysayers will no more prevent Alaska's development than they prevented Nebraska's or that of Kansas. The government now has its own railroad in Alaska. We have our own ships, which may be assigned to operate in connection with the railroad, bringing things in and out of the ports. Time and the normal course of economic conditions will bring Alaskan resources into their ultimate own. One resource that bears attention is petroleum. There's petroleum in the territory. There's a small production already affording a profitable return. It's oil being drawn in Alaska, refined in Alaska, and destined for consumption by Alaskans. There are developments now in process by some of the larger commercial oil interests in the United States, and there are dreams of measureless oil resources in the most northerly sections of Alaska, which are expressed in terms which sound more imaginary or fabulous than real. They sound too good to be true. But if I emphasize the need for caution in Alaska's development, it's for this reason. If we are to turn Alaska over to the exploiters, to have one after another of its resources wrenched out of it by ruthless means of mass efficiency, if we do that, we'll never create a state that's worthy of its destiny. If, for example, we shall go on decimating the fisheries year by year until they've been ruined, and then because a rise in the price of paper shall have made it profitable, we'll turn over the forests for exploitation and destruction. In short, if we are to loot Alaska, as the possibility of profit arises now in one direction or another, then we shall never have a state in Alaska. We shall never have a community of established society and a people tied to their homes in Alaska. But if, on the other hand, we are to make a great, powerful, wealthy, and permanent community of Alaska, if we are to place its star in our flag, to shine for a land of hope and homes and opportunity for the average man, then we must commit ourselves to a program of moderation, of control, of rounded, uniform development. We must encourage the present tendency to make homes, to bring wives, to raise families, to regard life in lovely, wonderful Alaska as an end, not as a means. In another direction, there's justification for road and rail building in Alaska. Much of Alaska will, in yet another generation, be rich and productive. Today it's unexplored, to say nothing of being mapped and equipped with highways. No discovery of riches should be kept from rational development for want of access to it. The federal government is here to be a leader in providing that access. And we've started with the Alaska Railroad. Alaska is so vast a region that merely to prospect it thoroughly will take a matter of generations, with a much larger population than Alaska now possesses. Aside from all of this, there is the necessity to expand the railroad which the government has built and is now operating. More than $56 million have been spent to build 500 miles of railroad. Now, understand, it was not built with the expectation of immediate or even early profit. Rather, it stands in much the same relation to Alaska that the Union Pacific did to our widely separated ocean fronts, east and west, when it was constructed far in advance of economic justification of development of California and the western states. The railroad was there first. And the Alaska Railroad is a pledge. It's a testimony of faith. It's a declaration of our firm confidence in the future of all Alaska. I am altogether an optimist on Alaska and its future. I do not believe Alaska can be forced, or that it should be. There is no need of government-managed, federally paid-for, hothouse development in Alaska. You know, Alaska is all right. It's doing well. It has more wealth and more population even now than some of the states did when they were admitted to the Union. We've been paid back many times for every dollar spent on Alaska, and the dividends have only begun. Hear this. Alaska is destined for ultimate statehood. My feeling is one of pride and faith in Alaska. With our rational helpfulness, with our justifiable generosity, her people will work out the destiny of this enchanting empire and turn a wonderland of riches and incomparable fascination to added power and new glory to the entirety of our great republic.
The last speech ever given by President Warren G. Harding, and the date and place again?
It was July 27th. It's in Seattle, Washington. An address given before 25,000 plus people at the University of Washington Stadium.
And the speech itself was actually 2 hours.
Yes.
Yeah. And he was not well at the time.
No.
Not well at the time. We're going to take a break. We've got a whole nother hour with President Harding coming up. Don't you dare go anywhere.
Help create memories you and your family will never forget. Take Route 2 to the Route 53 North exit and follow the signs. Just 17 miles west of Cedar Point via Route 6 in Port Clinton, Ohio. Open every day. Rain.